In just a moment, keys to the Capitol. But first, keeping informed in this busy world of ours is a problem. Events happen so quickly, we haven't time to hear the real story. Well, NBC solved that problem for you with a series of special news programs all week long. Programs designed to bring you not only the headlines, but the story behind the headlines. There's Keys to the Capitol, which you'll hear in just a few seconds, and other fine features like Meet the Press, Youth Wants to Know, and many more all through the week. Keep informed the easy, the complete way, the NBC radio way. And now stay tuned for Keys to the Capitol on NBC. What's going on in Washington?
Mr. Dulles has many problems.
They just don't see it our way. Congress talks hearings.
Congress gets religion.
From Washington, NBC News brings you transcribed Keys to the Capitol, a weekly news program in which the National Broadcasting Company's top Washington reporters and commentators discuss with you the news of the week and what's behind it. Tonight you'll hear Joseph C. Harsh, Leif Eade, Arthur Barrio, and Earl Godwin. NBC News has given these men the weekly assignment of going through Washington's official doors to learn the background of our national policies. And first, here's correspondent Joseph C. Harsh.
John Foster Dulles hasn't admitted it to anyone yet, but I suspect that in the back of his mind, he's beginning now to share a wistful thought that used to cross the minds of his predecessor, Dean Acheson, many times. Mr. Acheson admitted privately, I don't think he ever did it publicly, that he wished sometimes that he might have been Secretary of State, or rather Foreign Minister of the United States, back some time ago. He used to talk about how nice it was to have been a foreign minister in the 17th century, that is, back in the 1600s, when a foreign minister was the king's minister, and when there was no parliament that seriously got in the way. This idea of a foreign minister having to defer to a parliament, after all, belongs to fairly recent history. It really dates from the Cromwellian Revolution in England. Before that, Parliament was convened to provide money, but Parliament never dared to interfere with any such high-level operation as the making of foreign policy. Mr. Acheson was well aware of that. He had to negotiate not only with his allies and deal against his enemies, but he also had to negotiate constantly with the Congress. Now Mr. Dulles is in about that same position, and I must say that I, for one, don't envy him his job. He spent a lifetime wanting that job, but here he is, trying to hold the alliance together at a particularly precarious moment when Germany is rising and reaching for sovereignty, when the communists are about to make good a claim for Indochina. They're winning it by force of arms. And while Mr. Dulles is dealing with these great problems of foreign policy, he also has to negotiate with the Senate, a whole Congress, but mostly the Senate, really, that is really off the rails. During the last 2 weeks, when this Indochina issue was coming to a head in Geneva, and when Germany was rising up and demanding that sovereignty which was promised to her if she ratified EDC, which she did long ago, at this time, Mr. Dulles had to stay right here in Washington and spend all of his time trying to persuade the Congress, particularly the Senate, not to do things which would complicate his problems overseas. Now, actually, the problems Mr. Dulles had with the Congress were never quite as great as they appeared to be. Congress always goes through much the same process it did in the last 2 weeks, threatening to cut out the foreign aid bill, threatening to put all sorts of limiting restrictions upon it. It is partly for posturing, for election time use. The truth of the matter is that the foreign aid bill is bound, always was bound, to remain just about where it was, for the simple reason that most of the money we send overseas is used to buy up American
surpluses.
May
I interrupt you a minute, Mr. Harsh?
Yeah, surely.
When you're talking about the uprising in Congress, is it not, to my mind, maybe to yours too, it shows an interest on the part of the people, anyhow. Then those folks in Congress represent the people. And as you say, as soon as they blew up, and State Department went up there and talked to them quietly, and they seemed to be satisfied.
Yeah, they blamed some facts of life, yeah. Such as the fact that if you cut off foreign aid to France and Italy, you may wreck the system of air bases upon which we depend for containing, for restraining, or deterring Russian military power. And when you explain those things to the Congress, they back down. But, of course, the real thing that caused them to back down was the fact that had they really knocked the foreign aid bill into a cocked hat, it would have come right back on them in a reduction of export of American crop surpluses. Mm-hmm. So they vote the foreign aid in the end to keep American crop surpluses off the domestic market.
They always put a clause in there, don't they, Joe, about part of this has got to be sent in American crop surpluses anyway.
That's right.
Never foreign aid.
That's right. Roughly half of it or more. And so the thing was never as bad as it seemed. But the fact remains that Mr. Dulles, who is the foreign minister of the United States, has had to spend much more time in the last 2 weeks negotiating with Congress than he could spend negotiating with our allies or with our enemies.
He ought to have a Nixon.
He ought to have a Nixon, right.
He has a Nixon.
What he should have, Earl, I think, is what the British have, a parliamentary undersecretary.
Do they do
somebody
that?
Who would sit in the Congress and speak for him and defend his policies or explain them to the Congress at all times.
Well, now, Joe, what about the EDC thing?
Well, what about it?
Well, I mean, is that tied? That's tied up, of course, with German demands for sovereignty, isn't it?
Yes, Germany is one of the great rising powers in the world, and it has to be recognized. We and the British hope profoundly that the recognition of German sovereignty can take place within the framework of this EDC concept, which was designed to rearm Germany without turning her loose as a separate force in the world. And it's vital that something like this be done. These are very troublesome and difficult times because, you know, we're moving out of a chapter of history. From 1945 down to the present, we were living in a two-power world. Physical power, the world around, had polarized in Washington and Moscow. Now that's changing because Germany is rising as a power and China is rising as a power. And the thing that that gives the boys at the State Department nightmares these days is the awful thought that at the time when China is rising and is under Russian control, Germany is rising and might break loose from our control. Now, if we can hold Germany as tight as the Russians hold China, you can preserve a balance of power in the world. But if we should lose Germany and they don't lose China, then we really are in an awful spot. And this is what the foreign minister should be able to think about all the time and worry about instead of having to go up to Congress when he probably ought to be in Geneva, Paris, London, and Bonn.
Well, could we hold Germany only through EDC?
Well, no. That is not the only means, but it is the best means. It's the best means any of our diplomats have ever been able to figure out, Republicans or Democrats. They're both in total agreement on that. That EDC is the best solution for the German problem. The British are in agreement on that, too. But supposing you can't get EDC through, and that depends on the French, then what do you do? We have to turn Germany loose. We've got to give West Germany her sovereignty. And at that point, the German government of Konrad Adenauer is perfectly free to negotiate or make treaties or deals of any kind she wants with anybody. Now, we are banking on the fact that Adenauer is, as the diplomats say, oriented to the West. But the foreign policy orientation of a country is not a fixed thing like the laws of the Medes and Persians. It's a variable.
Well, is West Germany likely to become as great a power as was Germany?
No. But that isn't the immediate question. The immediate
question
is whether West Germany will be an adequate counterpoise in the world balance of power to China.
Well, Joe, of course, we never could hold Germany in check for any great length of time, and it's probable, or at least it's possible, that EDC is only a front. I mean, it would crumble away in a short time, isn't it?
Well,
isn't
it might
possible?
Crumble away, Leif, but at least you set a pattern of relationship among the Western countries. You have a marriage, and it's harder to break out of a marriage once you've signed the marriage contract and gone to the altar than it is to get away from an engagement that's never been consummated at the altar. Right?
Yeah.
It's an extra safeguard.
Well, of course, this EDC problem is no problem between us and the British. But that doesn't mean at all that we don't have our differences with the British and with the British people as well as with the British government. The main difference right now is over whether you can strike a really worthwhile deal with the communist world. Our position is that you can't now, and won't be able to in the foreseeable future. Well, the British, and that goes for the people too, suspect otherwise. They think that they see evidence, for instance, that Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai want to stop Red China's war with the Western world and get along on a live and let live basis. And you don't hear any voices in Britain raised against Winnie Churchill's idea, and he still holds that idea very firmly, of a big three meeting to find out what Russia's real intentions are. Now, this basic difference between American opinion and British opinion has probably been intensified, and intensified the recent anti-American feeling in the British Isles. But that anti-Americanism has been growing over there for quite a while. It seems to have three main sources. One is Senator McCarthy. They look on the man from Wisconsin as a reckless demagogue, persecuting helpless teachers and anybody else who disagrees with him. And they wonder what sort of a people we are and what sort of a government we have that is willing to put up with Senator McCarthy. And then there's a widespread feeling in Britain, it's a fear, really, that we're dragging the British into another world war, a war in which Britain would be right up front in a push-button war. That instant and massive retaliation at times and places of American choosing doesn't sound at all good to the British. And finally, there's a feeling that we're pushing the British around, making all the decisions and then telling the British about them afterwards. That we brush off Britain's knowledge about foreign relations that she has gained over centuries of experience. Then when you cross the channel into France, you find the same pushed-around feeling, that we're inclined to write France off as a power and as a leader in Europe and a great contributor to the world's culture. And that's a very touchy point for the French. Any worthwhile analysis of the political mood in France would take at least a couple of hours. But it strikes me that one of the main considerations with the average Frenchman is a deep longing for security, a security that he hasn't been able to get. That and the insistence that France is still a great world power. While France hasn't been able to solve her economic problems at home and overseas, her empire has been crumbling away chunk by chunk. Jin Bien Phu was a terrible blow. And it led to the deeper suspicion than ever in the average Frenchman, that his government had been lying to him for years. All the time when it wasn't being led around by the nose by the United States. The Frenchman feels that France carried the war for the West, single-handedly in Indochina. And that we did a lot of talking, but when the showdown came and the military manpower was needed, we just weren't there. As for the EDC, the French would like to have a few more guarantees. First, that we and the British will never pull off the continent and leave France by itself to face Germans with rifles on their shoulders. And second, that there'll be no possibility ever that Germany will just take charge of the EDC. Either that or sometime pull out of the European army. As one Frenchman put it, a large part of French opinion is still emotionally apprehensive at the prospect of a revived German national army. He said, in the minds of our people, a German army signifies invasion, ruin, and death. You know, the French can't forget that three times in 80 years, Germany has invaded France. I think a lot of our trouble is right there. Don't you think so, Joe?
Yes, of course that's a lot of trouble. There's a lot more to it than that, Leif. And if I may go back, I would like to challenge, not completely but partially, one statement you made at the beginning. You said, as I recall, you said that you think we cannot have an... In this country, we think we cannot have an agreement with the communist world.
Yeah, the prevailing American opinion.
You stated the concept of non-coexistence, that it can't happen.
I think that's...
That is a popular point of view. Mm-hmm. And the spokesman of the administration in the Congress, as I think distinct from the administration itself, tends to adopt that point of view. But what I would question is whether the administration really does think that.
Well, I didn't say the administration.
I was talking
about general American feeling.
General American feeling. Mr. Dulles has made a number of speeches in which, in effect, he accepted the possibility of coexistence.
Mm.
And the president himself has said that coexistence is the alternative.
He has laid that down flatly.
I think myself that the key to this argument lies in a phrase that Winston Churchill used at his press conference when he was here in Washington. He said, with vigilance.
With vigilance.
With vigilance.
Sure.
I think people sometimes overlook the fact that there are not just two alternatives, coexistence or non-coexistence. There is coexistence at one end. There is coexistence with vigilance in the middle. And there's war at the other.
All right.
Now, if you... Coexistence with vigilance means maintaining your arm strength. Mm. And I submit myself that one of the troubles right now is that there is a great urge in this country to escape the vigilance part of it, but an equal reluctance to go to to war. We don't want war, but we don't want to pay the price of vigilance for coexistence. We can have coexistence with it.
I think in the minds of the ordinary American, this business of coexistence between our kind of folks and the Russians means simply this, that the two neighbors living in adjacent houses minding their own business.
That's right.
The popular idea of Russia and the Russians and the Reds and so forth is they're just a lot of rampaging pirates and overrunning everybody else's property.
Right.
Well, isn't there a fear of appeasement entering into this?
Surely.
Well, that's
coexistence without vigilance leads to appeasement. But coexistence is not necessarily appeasement. It's only appeasement if you drop the vigilance.
Yeah,
but
true.
If you're my neighbor and you're in the habit of throwing broken bottles over my fence and causing a lot of trouble, and if I build a high enough fence or call in the law and say, look, boys, no more of this. If I have enough vigilance and enough strength to back it up, you're going to subside and let that fence be a truce line, a neutral line.
That's a coexistence, but it's sort of an armed peace. It's not peaceful coexistence.
Oh, that's right.
That's true. That's
I can't myself see the slightest prospect of a peaceful coexistence with the Russians. I think all you get is a kind of balance of power maintained by equal strength on our side.
Well, I think this feeling is much stronger in Britain that there could be a peaceful coexistence, with vigilance, mind you. A larger trade, for instance, and the gradual breaking down of the barriers. When he was over here, if we could only convince the Russians that there's some fun to be had in this world as well as a lot of austerity,
we would
sort of have won the battle, and we could put off. He said 25 years, for instance, in one period of peaceful coexistence with the West would give the average Russian an enormous benefit from a higher standard of living, and apparently beyond that, he couldn't see beyond that. Nobody can see for 25 years even. But having got that far, that there would be working toward peace.
Well, what he's counting on is the operation of an old historical law that revolutions tend to lose their momentum. The steam goes out from under them, and they kind of settle down. France is a revolutionary government, actually. The present French government is founded on the French Revolution at the end of the 18th century. But France is not really an aggressor anymore.
No.
And yet back around
George,
1800, the English were just as scared of the French as we're scared of the Russians today.
They were the Bolsheviks of their time.
Sure.
George Kennan had the same idea in his what do you call that line that he was drawing around?
Containment.
He said that if you kept this line strong enough for a long enough period, that the revolution in Russia would lose its steam, and the old leaders would die off, and the younger leaders would rise and see that, well, there wasn't much use in trying to spread this revolution over the world anyway, and they'd finally come to terms.
I think in the third generation, usually, the ardor has disappeared.
Well, there was a Russian refugee in Congress the other day, I think it was, before a press conference, Lisa, said that just what you were talking about, that communism is dying among the Russian people. It's no longer on the up and up, no longer a terrific crusade.
Of course, we're much more afraid of the Chinese.
Yeah, it's new with them.
They're new.
Yeah.
Well, there's somebody was saying that there are too many bureaucrats over there who've got a vested interest now in holding a good job.
Well, gentlemen, let's come home for a while here and face the fact that Congress is not too pleased over public reaction to these hearings of recent memory. One need hardly say they were long, drawn out, and confused by side issues, with the result that on Capitol Hill we've heard cries of change the rules. But will they be changed? If you know Congress, you also know that Congress hates to change that which has existed over the years, hates to give up its prerogatives. We hear, for example, a statement that Congress should do away with one-man subcommittees. But good as that may sound to those concerned about the rights of witnesses, the fact remains that in many cases, a one-man subcommittee for Congress is often a handy thing. It frees committee members who may be involved with other matters, who may be tied up on business, or who may at the moment be tied up with visiting constituents. So there is, I think, a good chance that this one-man subcommittee will remain. I think, too, that in discussing these hearing rules, we should bear this in mind. The public has come to regard hearings, for the most part, as a matter of hunting Reds and tracking down subversives. And actually, as you know, this field represents only a small part of the overall. The hearing remains a mighty important thing in such matters as appropriations or in determining domestic legislation. Well, these fields, we know, are less dramatic, but altogether necessary. So perhaps we can expect Congress to do nothing that would upset them. Well, altogether, as we understand now, a special Senate Rules Subcommittee is studying 9 proposed rule changes. And involved here is one great overlap, the duplication of effort on the part of Senator McCarthy's Permanent Investigating Committee and Senator Jenner's Internal Security Subcommittee. Both, as you know, have declared open season on the Reds. We've seen the time when, joined by the House Committee on Un-American Activities, when we've wondered who would get what witness. Well, it's this conflict, it's this rivalry, as it were, that Congress would like to eliminate. To accomplish this, we might see the day when one joint committee composed of both senators and representatives take over the Red Hunt. Such a move, of course, would place Senator McCarthy in a subordinate role, but at least it would keep Congress from tripping all over itself as it has been doing. I think also we can look forward a little, if any, cross-examination of witnesses. The recent hearings notwithstanding, Congress ordinarily likes to keep them brief and to the point. To sum up on the subject, I see perhaps the establishment of a joint committee to handle the subversive field, but otherwise, few changes. What do you think about it, Earl?
Well, about that joint committee or the whole business?
Well, a joint committee to take over this entire business of the Reds.
Well, I believe that would be ideal, but you run up against the human element and the human politician who just wallows in the idea of being a committee chairman. And a chairman of a committee on the House side has a great deal of power, a great deal of prestige, and yet he is probably duplicating the work that a chairman on the Senate side has done. Of course, under our system of government, we have to have committees in the House that examine into appropriations and matters of legislation, and the same type of committee in the Senate does the same thing, and they drag out the legislation a long, long time, but we can't change that very well. But in these matters such as un-American activities and atomic energy and subjects of that kind, I have been told by leaders in the Senate on both sides that would be the ideal, and I believe an effort will be made to establish a joint committee or committees on one or more of these subjects in the next Congress, not the next session.
Yeah, that's right. There's one example where there's a triplicate effort made. You had the Veldy House Un-American Activities Committee,
yeah,
the Jenner Subcommittee, and the McCarthy Committee, all angling and all trying to get the same witnesses.
Well, the administration patronizes the Jenner Committee, with it throws all its red business to the Jenner Committee.
May I suggest that we be a little more precise about the work of the proper role of Congress in this area? I wish I could quote, I cannot, the exact words the President used in his first State of the Union message, wasn't it, where he was talking about the responsibility of the executive authority to police itself.
Primary responsibility.
The executive has the primary responsibility. Now, one thing I've never been able to grasp in all this, I just don't believe it, that is the contention of those people that somehow a congressional committee can actually hunt communists. I don't believe that a congressional committee has the ability, the physical ability, to ever find communists. The finding of communists is done by the secret police of the government, which in this case would be the FBI. You have two secret police agencies of the United States government, the CIA, which works outside the territorial limits of the United States, the FBI, which works inside the territorial limits. Now, the FBI has a very large staff of highly trained secret operatives who infiltrate the communist organization, sometimes spend years underground in the communist network. They're the people who find communists. All that a congressional committee can ever do is sort of oversee the operations of the FBI and the CIA and make sure that they're on their toes and working all the time. But no congressional committee, with its limited and recurrent appropriations, with its limited staff, ever has the real ability. How can a congressional committee plant a man underground in a communist organization for 10 years? You can't do it. You must rely on the FBI to do the job.
You know what they would say to you in the answer?
What?
There's only one name, Alger Hiss. I mean, they got one.
I'd like to argue.
Well,
I don't know.
Hadn't the FBI done the spade work there?
The FBI had done some spade work, all right, but it was never convicted until a congressional committee got on the job. I mean, I'm not saying I'm not right, but I say that that would be the answer.
I don't think it would work, Joe, entirely, because there are many things that the FBI has to do under law and the matters of
Yes, but it's the primary responsibility of the FBI to catch communists.
Well, anyhow, you fellas can argue that a little bit later. I'm going to get down to the Sawdust Trail here and tell you that I'd like to surprise you by reporting a very great fact, a quiet fact about Congress, and that is the rising tide of interest in the old-fashioned Orthodox Bible teachings. Congress is going religious, with many a senator, old-fashioned religion is expressing itself by frequent expressions like morality as opposed to legality in dealing with such ferocious questions as the proposed administration admission of the Red Chinese government into the United Nations. There are several United States senators who are long-time, deep students of the Bible and who could hold their own with any of the better-than-average college experts on the subject. I've canvassed the House of Representatives a couple of times in the past few years on the news story and have found at least a third of that 435 membership putting religion and church attendance in the forefront of their activities and thoughts. And that goes for Protestants, Catholics, and Jews. And recently Congress set aside that little room right off the Capitol Rotunda called the Prayer Room. It's a plain table and chair arrangement for simply quiet meditation. I can't begin to enumerate, having time, all the national lawmakers who are Bible experts. There are a lot of them, but I'll mention a few. Senator Carlson of Kansas is renowned internationally in his work in the Organization for Christian Leadership, and Senator Alexander Wiley is an expert and scholarly student of the Bible. Senator Flanders of Vermont, also Freer of Delaware, Symington of Missouri. Particularly interesting at the moment is the fact that Senator Willis Robertson of Virginia this past week sent to the newspapers, radio stations, and to many individuals in his district or in his state a weekly letter, and the subject matter was the decadence of moral stamina throughout the nations on which we are depending for strong support in our idealistic stand for freedom and anti-communism. And then Robertson reports that there's a strong religious revival throughout Europe and that he believes this stirring within the souls and breasts of the people of that area as well as the United States foretells a great defeat of legality versus morality. In fact, better times. Now, this is all historically interesting because of the well-known fact that our founding fathers were of strong religious strain, and our Constitution and every state constitution but one, West Virginia, has in it a mention of the Creator. I don't think that's come to the popular attention lately. I thought you folks might like to learn about it.
Earl, I don't want to sound irreverent, but it strikes me that there's something a little, shall we say, revolutionary in this. Now, I make my point this way. Two of the basic teachings of the Christian religion, as I understand it, are charity and tolerance. If Congress really goes religious and practices the basic Christian virtues of charity and tolerance, is there not going to have to be some modification of the habit of abusing one's opponent in Congress?
Joe, you got me down on another platform. I was talking about what these people are saying to their folks at home. Of course, you can, if we're going to be perfect, we must be charitable and we must be tolerant.
Don't you think that it might be a good thing if there were injected?
You have been listening to Keys to the Capitol, brought to you transcribed by NBC News, as a way of taking you behind the doors of official Washington with NBC's top reporters and commentators. Tonight you have heard Joseph C. Harsh, Leif Eed, Arthur Barrio, and Earl Godwin. Keys to the Capitol will be brought to you at this same time next week. This is the NBC Radio Network.